The following podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com. And now get ready, because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
They say that we should be despising these movies, but we'll decide that for ourselves. This is the Movie Dude Eric. Along with me are...
This is Kent.
And this is John Lobster.
And this is Art House Rejects.
Reject.
This episode we're discussing Dune, starring Kyle MacLachlan, Sean Young, Kenneth MacMillan, Brad Dourif, Jose Ferrer, Linda Hunt, Jürgen Prochnow, Patrick Stewart, Sting, Dean Stockwell, Max von Sydow, and directed by David Lynch. All right, did I put enough names in there?
No, I think the cast is actually a little bit bigger than that.
Yeah, there are so many awesome people in this.
Yes, for a movie that was one of the very few that got a 0-star rating from Roger Ebert.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, when you have Captain Jean-Luc Picard, Father Marin, and Brother Cavill all in your movie, in the small... finger quotes roles, you have a pretty damn good movie.
As well as Agent Dale Cooper, and Brad Dourif, because Brad Dourif is just Brad Dourif.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yes. This is awesome. Oh, and Sting, by the way, like a little known player, whatever, you know, singer, whatever he is.
Yeah.
You know, from some band that nobody's ever heard of.
And you know, we have a Star Wars actor Max von Sydow joins us here.
Yes, indeed.
And of course, Al. Who forgets Al from Quantum Leap?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You said mentioned his Battlestar Galactica name. No, he's Quantum Leap to a lot of people too. So
very true.
Yeah.
All right.
What I realized the other day, and I'm going to go off on a tangent. So there's a new NCIS that stars Scott Bakula.
Yeah.
Now NCIS is a spinoff of JAG. This NCIS is a spinoff of the other NCIS, which is a spinoff of JAG, which was created by Donald Belisario, who created Quantum Leap.
Yes.
Ah.
So things have literally come full circle for Scott Bakula.
That's true. But for me, I don't know. It's just like Belisario. I want another Quantum Leap. I'm sorry. I'm going to say it right now. I want another Quantum Leap.
We can talk about that.
Yes, we can. But we're here for Dune. We're here because...
We are.
First off, last year was the 50th anniversary of the novel by Frank Herbert, which got very little fanfare. And considering just how prolific and how... I don't think anyone really appreciated just how much of Dune has kind of come to pass, which is really kind of strange. I mean, we don't have any messiahs.
Talking about like ISIS?
Well, part of it, but I mean, just the importance of the Middle East. I mean,
very true.
Dune, if anything, Dune's an allegory for environmentalism. It's also an allegory for the Middle East and the power struggles for energy and power.
Yeah. It's about putting basically all of your, all of your trust and faith and importance in one single commodity. And then completely disregarding the people that live where that commodity is found.
And I find it interesting that no one has ever made the leap here. Okay, the name of the planet Dune is Arrakis. Iraq.
Ah.
Oh, it's like they thought about it or something.
I find it hilarious. It's like they're calling them Arrakeen, and all I'm thinking is Iraqi. Like,
no, it can't be the same place. Arrakis starts with an A. It's clearly... Yeah, but I see what you mean. I think it's the same people I would probably mention this to are the ones that would hate the movie, that would go, that's a totally different thing and you're completely off because blah, blah, blah. Like, no.
Okay, let's put it this way. We have ourselves nomadic tribes of religiously volatile peoples who are waiting for a messiah and are willing to kill in order to do so, with massively backwards traditions who hate their occupiers. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. There are certain elements that are totally allegorical. And we can totally draw parallels. But I think that goes as far back as the actual spice trade, right? Like,
yeah,
when the actual spice trade happened, this same type of stuff was happening to the native people that lived there that were then enslaved and forced to. I mean, kind of the difference was the people mining the spice weren't the Fremen. They were like outsiders. Labor that were, yeah, outsiders yeah. that were brought in. And it wasn't the Fremen that were killing them. It was the sandworms that were killing them because probably it's not a union gig. So, you know, people are like getting eaten and stuff all the time.
Okay, the problem
here is they just need to unionize.
When you say that, part of me wants to go into the book because I am very familiar with the book. And there is actually, that is kind of wrong because there's been a blood feud between the Fremen and specifically the Harkonnen.
Harkonnens, well, yeah.
Nobody likes Harkonnens.
Well, the Harkonnens are the asshole outsiders that don't care about anything but profit.
They're the sheriff from, remember in Harlan County, USA, the sheriff that comes in and is like, now. Or what was his name? Basil. Remember Basil?
Mm-hmm.
They're fucking Basil coming in.
Well, no, but get this though. I mean, if you really want to look at it, the Harkonnen are the old style colonialists, the ones that have for generations held onto Arrakis through sheer force, which is European all the way, and the Atreides. Which again kind of reeks of American, so it's kind of like the Atreides are there to kind of help liberate but to kind of make things fair for the Fremen. They're not really going to give it back because they're going to keep, you know, because the spice must flow, you know, the oil must flow, but you know they're a lot more nicer and they're a lot more fair to the Fremen than the Harkonnens. So there's layers in this story, and part of me is like I'm gonna try my hardest to stay away from the book because the movie is the movie is like the Cliff's Notes of the book.
It's a different, it's right. a completely different animal, and honestly, I totally understand the hate among true diehard fans of the book. Hating the film the same way as another sci-fi epic that got the Hollywood treatment about 10 years later, Starship Troopers. I totally get it. That said, I think that David Lynch, at least in the, you know, what he intended for the film, was as close as they were probably going to get to adapting the novel and still making an interesting movie, because we've seen what a more faithful adaptation looks like. It's like a sci-fi miniseries a sci-fi channel miniseries that is totally boring.
But no, believe it or not, that actually is it has some of the stuff that the Lynch movie didn't have. Most of that stuff is filler that wasn't even in the book to begin with. In all honesty, I'd say the Lynch one is actually a little bit more faithful to the book than the sci-fi miniseries.
Right.
But that and said, there, though, I'm going.
And again, this wasn't the first attempt at making a Dune movie. There was, prior to this, I mean, Dino De Laurentiis had been interested in making a Dune movie for a while and had been kind of shopping it around and playing with it. And there were other directors attached. One of them
was Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Right. And you recently saw the documentary about that.
Yes. It's crazy. I mean, Jodorowsky's vision would have been extremely unique, but we're talking about the ideas that he had, especially at the time that he was going to do this, would have been at least like $150 million.
Right.
And then we're talking about like early 80s. Late 70s, $150 million.
So and there was evidently a 400-page phone book of a script floating around too.
Yeah. Well, if you want to do a perfect adaptation of the book, you're going to have a 10-hour movie.
Right.
Okay. But the thing is that there's going to be one hero in this movie, right. and I got to say it right now, the true genuine hero of this movie is Anthony Masters. You're asking yourself, who is Anthony Masters? Anthony Masters is the production designer because this movie looks gorgeous. I'm not talking about the cinematography. Yeah. We're talking about the sets. We're talking about the costumes. Okay, I'll be honest here. Even now when I read the book, the images of this movie are what plays in my head. I don't play images of the movie, but Bene Gesserit. I can't think of the Bene Gesserit as any other way. I love the look of these women that look, they kind of look like nuns and monks at the same time. And especially considering that they're the keepers of the religion, right? They're the ones that are trying to find the Kwisatz Haderach. They are the fervent. They're they reek of kind of the Catholicism, right? You know, they play kingmakers between the houses of the Lansrot.
They feel like the Jedi should have been in the prequels.
No, to me,
in some ways, yeah.
But the thing is, I'm getting a Catholic feeling off of them.
Well, yeah.
A massive. I'm talking about like and I think that this was intentional with what David Lynch was going for. This feels like futuristic Dark Ages. There's a true look of kind of feudalism. The costumes, the sets all feel like they have spaceships, but in all essence, this is the Dark Ages. This is knights and fiefs and kings and kingdoms, castles, right? I mean, hell, you look at that temple. That's a castle, right? There's definitely a Middle Eastern vibe to it, but it has a European castle element to it.
Well, and the technology is, this strikes me as steampunk before we knew what steampunk was.
Yeah,
especially when they're defending at the Harkonnens are defending at the end, that council they're sitting at where they're shooting the remote guns is like, that is so steampunk right there.
Well, like, it looks like a video game carousel.
Yeah, that's all brass knob stuff on it. And
okay, yeah. I do have a question. I want to start off with this question. When you watch this for this podcast, did you understand a damn thing that happened the first time?
No. Because, well, my first time seeing this film was that Sci-Fi Channel extended cut with like the like half hour of exposition at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, after watching that one a couple times, I finally got a copy of the DVD, watched it all the way through, read the book, watched it again. Now I can watch it just half paying attention and know exactly what's going on because I've mastered Dune. But to be honest, there is, I think for the initial viewing, there's a learning curve. And I honestly like movies that you have to watch a couple times to really understand what's going on. Otherwise, why watch them again?
Actually,
know I saw this on like VHS way back when. And I couldn't tell you when the next time I had seen it. I want to say this is the third or fourth time I've seen this version. And I have seen the Sci-Fi Channel version and read the book. So
I don't think I've ever watched the miniseries, but
it drags in some spots. But
listen, I'm going to out myself right now.
Uh-oh.
I love this movie.
Yeah.
I love it. It is not an art house reject for me. And again, as of last week, The Man Who Knew Too Little, I professed early on my love for that film. And I kind of, this was Kent's pick, and I egged him on a little bit to choose this because I love it.
And there's controversy behind it. There's
right. Yeah. There are people who defend it.
Can we talk about why people hate this movie?
Well, before we do, because Lobster, you decided to stamp on this landmine, and because you made me walk these coals last week, I want you to try to do your best to give us a synopsis of Dune.
Oh, okay. So there's this planet Arrakis, right? And again, this is the year 100,000 AD, something like that. So we're way, 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 way in the future.
Yeah. We're past Warhammer.
Yeah. We're out there. We're out there in the future. And basically the known universe has been conquered because they discovered on this planet Arrakis the substance, the spice melange, which you can use to do a whole bunch of different stuff. If you make it into a gas and inhale it, it'll mutate you into a floating like brain whale type thing. And then what you can do this really neat thing, which is you can actually fold space, which makes faster than light transportation possible, and you can travel all over the galaxy. So that's cool. People like that. The Mentax use it. They distill it into like a Kool-Aid, and then they drink this Kool-Aid, kind of like pom. It's like pomegranate juice if you've ever had it. And that makes them living computers. Cause also, I don't know if you caught this, but they outlawed real computers. So everybody has to have like a Mentac around to like do their calculations for them. Mm-hmm. So the spice is really super valuable. It's only found in one place, is planet Arrakis, which is a desert world, and custody of Arrakis has been, with House Harkonnen, which is not the ruling class of the Empire, but they're like up there. They're one of the major players. And they have a rival house, which is House Atreides. And they're like the good guys. And so what the Emperor, he kind of wants to get rid of the Atreides because they're a little too goody two shoes. So he makes a deal with the Harkonnens that he's going to remove the control of Arrakis from the Harkonnens, give it to the Atreides. They're all going to move to Arrakis, and then they're going to combine their power, the Harkonnens and the Emperor, and wipe out the Atreides once and for all. And that seems like a good plan, except the floating brain whales, they get a whiff of it because, you know, they have floating brain whale powers and they can like sniff out this kind of stuff. They're like, are you sure this is a good idea? Because we kind of get the feeling that Paul Atreides is going to be a bit of a problem. And they're like, Paul, you mean like the kid, like the whiny Wesley Crusher? Like, no way. Turns out, he is actually kind of a big deal. And we'll get to that in a second. Cause there are these other people running around, these ladies, the Bene Gesserit, and they've been fucking with stuff. And basically controlling who can and can't have sex with each other, because they want to make this thing called the Kwisatz Haderach, which is like the perfect, like God being. It's like the perfect human. Not the perfect human from the fifth element. That's like a different thing.
But I don't know. We'll get there.
Yeah. So they go ahead. And what's kind of fucked up is the wife of Duke Leto Atreides, Lady Jessica, is herself a Bene Gesserit. And she marries Paul Atreides, or she marries Leto, and then bears him a son, which is like totally verboten.
She's not a wife. She's not a wife. She's a concubine.
Yeah.
He actually never married.
Yeah, concubine. That's
because
good point.
Because of
rules and stuff.
You know, and you call yourself a Dune fan.
Right. Well, I'm trying to give the shorthand.
I know.
I'm trying to give the shorthand here. But so what happens is they go to Arrakis. Yada, yada, yada. Shit goes down. There's a lot of stuff in like the front half of this movie setting up different characters, some of whom are important and some of whom really, turn out to not be important. Shout out Mapes. That you got stabbed with the floaty thing, but, it's a bummer for you, but you were cool. It was nice to get to know you. Who is kind of important? I'll just name them off real quick. Duncan Idaho is kind of like their man on the ground. He's been getting to know the Fremen. Max von Sydow's character also is kind of like, he's been getting to know the Fremen. He explains how the still suits work. That's really cool. He's got the blue eyes, because if you hang out around the spice long enough, you get these wacky blue eyes, which is pretty cool. Gurney Halleck is important. He's played by Patrick Stewart. He's kind of like the man at arms of House Atreides.
He's the muscle.
Yeah, he's pretty cool. And Dr. Uwe. He's played by Dean Stockwell. He's been trained by the Empire, and it turns out he's the traitor who betrays them to House Harkonnen. Anyway, stuff goes down, and in the ensuing coup, Lady Jessica and Paul are taken away to be dumped in the middle of the desert and eaten by worms, thus destroying evidence of their deaths. For some reason, Baron Harkonnen, the floating fat guy, who's kind of a perv, is really interested in the Duke's signet ring, which is apparently important. That's like the badge of office. So he needs to grab that. He doesn't get it. It goes off with Paul into the desert. And it turns out that, the Mentak guy, who in addition to having the red lips has the cool bushy eyebrows, the Mentak that belongs to House Atreides gets captured, and he ends up having to milk a hairless cat duct taped to a rat in order to survive, which is pretty cool, and also messed up. And, Dean Stockwell's character, Dr. Yui, it turns out that he betrayed them because he hates the Harkonnens. So it was like a double gambit, or like a double cross, because he wanted to maneuver Leto Atreides close to the Baron so he could give him a poison tooth and then take out the Baron. But it doesn't work. It takes out Brad Dorf instead, who's Grima Wormtongue from Lord of the Rings. That's pretty.
I thought he looked familiar.
Yeah. Okay. He shows up in Star Trek too.
Yeah. He was also in the X-Files. He was.
Yeah. He's that guy from that thing that you know. Okay.
No, so he's Brad fucking Dorf. Don't be dissing him like that. Everybody knows who he is.
Let's follow up with Paul, because he's like the main character. And what's cool about Paul is while all of this stuff has been going on, he's been having these visions. And he's starting to see things that he's seen before in his visions. Like he's seen the second moon of Arrakis, that he's kind of like fixated on. He keeps seeing this hot girl, in his dreams too. Turns out that out in the desert, they meet the Fremen, and it turns out there's a bunch of them, and they have all this water that nobody even knew about. And they're like, yo, Paul, if you teach us to do that cool thing where you can use your voice to like blow up stuff. Which is, again, like another thing that I glossed over. Yeah, they can do that too. If you can train us to fight, we'll like let you hang with us. So Paul goes, yeah, okay, we'll hang out. And his mom's like, yeah, we'll hang out. Fine. And we'll teach you the weird stuff, which is like literally what they call it. It's the weirding way. So they hang out with the Fremen for like 2 years, teaching them, hanging out with them and stuff.
And becoming terrorists.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, use in the film, they use the word jihad, that they want to start a jihad against the Harkonnens who are controlling the spice and stuff. And they start like a little insurgency. They hook back up with, Patrick Stewart. But kind of what's going on in the background of all of this is Paul starts to take on like this messianic stature because it turns out that there's this prophecy among the Fremen that there's like two separate prophecies about Paul. One is the one that the Bene Gesserit have about this Kwisatz Haderach coming up, but also the Fremen kind of have a prophecy of an outsider that's going to come and finally free them. So all this shit kind of comes together with Paul, who picks the name Muad'Dib, which is like the one of the shapes on the second moon. He's like, what's that thing called? And they're like, oh yeah, that's Muad'Dib. And he's like, okay, I'm going to be Muad'Dib. That's cool. And it turns out that like a bunch of cool stuff. So like the word Muad'Dib becomes a killing word.
I love that. My own name is a killing word. Yeah. We're going to get into that because, there's a lot of religious elements to that one.
Yeah. So like, so that's cool. And also he figures out that to really like fully unleash his power and also like solidify his like prophetic stature, he has to drink the water of life, which I believe is like distilled worm juice, right?
Kinda.
It's like worm piss.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he's got to do this thing, which kills dudes. Like, it's bad for dudes. If women drink it, they can kind of become, the Bene Gesserit priestess and stuff. Oh, which by the way, his mom drank it and then, like, his sister was born freakishly early and then grew at a freakish rate and she's like a full on Bene Gesserit high mother.
She has all the knowledge of her mother.
Yeah.
Plus
extra stuff going on. So that's cool. And the blue eyes. Don't forget the blue eyes. Yeah. So Paul sucks down the water of life. Some cool stuff happens. He rides a fucking sandworm, which is pretty awesome. That's probably one of like the best parts in the movie. And basically, he is now this this incredible messianic character, and he's totally believing it. And he's like, okay, we're going to take the fight to the Harkonnens. They attack. The emperor has gotten wind that things are not so good on Arrakis. And the emperor, you find out, really doesn't have any power. It's all the floating brain whales that have the power. Because yeah. They're like, you know, fuck you, emperor. Like, we don't give a shit about you.
Yeah.
The spice must flow. If you're not going to make it happen, then, you know, it's not going to work out so well for you, emperor. Shaddam the Fourth. So anyway, climactic battle, atomic weapons, worm sign, the lakes of which God has ever seen, awesome music by Toto, and
don't forget Brian Eno.
And Brian Eno, who did a score as well, but they only use a little bit of it, which is all, I mean, come on, that's fantastic music. But the climactic battle happens. A lot of stuff happens all at once. They send the little sister in first as kind of like a messenger, and she's super creepy. And then she ends up like attacking the Baron, and he like flies off because she like pulls out his nipple clamps, and he zooms off into like the gullet of a sandworm, which is a pretty cool death. Finally, oh, did I mention that Sting is in this, and he's like a henchman to the Harkonnens?
No, he's always half naked.
He's a son of.
I think he's a nephew.
The heir.
He's nephew.
I think he's a nephew.
Oh, nephew.
So there's Fade Rutha and the Beast Raban are like the two nephews. The Beast Raban is the one who like fucks everything up. Plus he like eats pieces of cows who are just like hanging there, which is pretty gross. So he fucks everything up, gets his head cut off by the emperor, and then. Fade is like the one guy who like he doesn't say much, but he looks pretty crazy, so people don't mess with him. Even though he's skinny, he's a skinny dude.
But he's Sting, so
he is Sting, yeah. And he's got his little stinger and his little speedo.
And he loves to say, I will kill you.
Why prolong the inevitable? I will kill you. So he has a climactic duel with Muad'Dib, which is, this scene is actually pretty badass, because not only does Paul totally kick Sting's ass, he then shouts at him with his like Skyrim. He Fusrodas him without the weirding module, and then he literally makes it rain.
It's not a strip club.
It is not a strip club. He makes it rain. It has never rained on Arrakis. And Muad'Dib is like, look at all the fucks I give. And then he makes it rain.
I shall not sure come from the sky. What?
Okay, then, Kent. Ken.
Yeah.
Now tell me, after hearing that, why exactly is there hate for this movie?
Most of the hate... Okay. There's a bit of a rant coming here as I trace it. But most of the hate from this movie is the people who are the older guard, we'll say. People who would have been teen and older at the time the movie came out, who read the book and then were bitching because this one detail wasn't right or this one thing wasn't exactly the same. As the novel, therefore, flush the whole thing because it's not my vision. Because my vision is this 15 thing that can only be done as a 15-hour epic. Now, you've got people today who like, oh, there's a book adaptation of a movie. Let's go watch it. Let me point a finger at the Harry Potter fandom here. They're all – some of them have very serious problems with some of the Harry Potter films. But to say, hey, the next one's – if you were to look at them and say, oh, you didn't like – Prisoner of Azkaban. Okay, Order of the Phoenix is coming out. They're like, I'm first in line. But you hated the last one. I don't care. Even though they left out this detail, I like the movie anyway. The people who hated the Dune movie were like, well, you left out this detail, so if you ever made Children of Dune, which is the novel sequel to
it. Right, there are, and to be honest,
I'm not going to see it because you left out this little detail in the previous book. And they'll just go on about how you're stupid for liking this movie. And like, why? It's like this I don't know what it is. It's almost a sense of entitlement that like, I read this. How dare you bring it to the masses and leave out this chapter? Like, so?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, but I don't think that many people read the book. I mean, not to the movie audience. Let me go ahead and I want to throw just a few words out there, and if this wasn't a part of this, if it wasn't a part of something that you're familiar with, tell me if you would be going the fuck. Okay, hold on.
That's milking, a question.
Milking cats. Big ass worms, let's see, messiahs, spaceships, brain beings, spices that turn you into mutants, bald ladies, let's see here, I'm just trying to be on the nice side here.
All these things become sci-fi tropes right on anyway.
They do, but you have to understand that for the people who have never read the book, and you have to be very careful with book adaptations, especially of this sort, because the average person who never read the book, and they go into this, considering that there is no learning curve, there is no learning curve in this movie. This is Cliff's Notes of a book the appendices to Dune is as thick as the book itself.
Yeah.
Okay, there is no learning curve on Dune. And again, I respect what the movie was trying to do and how gorgeous it looks and how twisted it looks. Only David Lynch could give us these visuals, and I am deeply thankful for him trying his hardest to bring this. And one thing I've got to say is, understand, the producer here is Dino De Laurentiis. Are you familiar with Dino De Laurentiis? This guy could actually out penny pinch Roger Corman. Okay? This guy is one of the cheapest producers who ever lived. Okay, you know,
it doesn't show it with set design. It shows it with special effects, though.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a legendary story about Dino De Laurentiis. Okay, the guy, when it came time to do the rap party, he was so cheap. He put out a bowl of chips, not even dip, just chips and water for the rap party. Okay, this guy is so cheap. You know, he makes Scrooge McDuck look like a freaking philanthropist. Okay? I'm not kidding here. So, Dino De Laurentiis, and the fact that David Lynch made such an epic-looking film, and no matter what you say about the movie and how twisted and crazy it is epic. You feel the epic elements of the story. When you see the word Dune just take over the scene, I'll say there are times when it feels as epic as Star Wars.
I might get myself in some hot water here, but I think that Dune as a story is probably more epic than Star Wars.
I will actually agree. Yeah. But that's because Frank Herbert created
possibly
one of the greatest epics of all time. I mean, there's a reason why Dune has rivaled Lord of the Rings as one of the greatest epic stories of modern history. And it's because his story, you feel the history, you feel the epic scope. That there, I mean, with this movie, they created these kind of places where Princess Irulan, who's played by Virginia Madsen, to kind of come and tell some of the backstory, which is actually what she does in the book too. This is all told in retrospect, you know, kind of archives. But, you know, Princess Irulan was the major chronicler of Paul Modib. And, you know, so they kind of played that here. Although I had to admit, the way that they just had her kind of like photoshopped into these spaces, I thought were hilarious.
And she like fades out. Oh, and she's like, oh, I forgot to tell you that, you know. And that's kind of how I felt giving my recap a little bit. She's like, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you this one thing, and it's crazy, but, you know. But listen, I want to go back to what you were saying about, like, how accessible is this film to new viewers? And I know that as a kid, when I was watching this on like cable, when it was on, I grokked the heck out of this. Like I was like, yes, give me more of this. This looks so cool. And it has so many epic, like, fuck yeah moments. Like, there, I counted at least half a dozen fuck yeah moments in this movie where you're like, fuck yeah.
I'll be honest. I saw, the first time I saw this was on Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah. Same here.
And I never heard, I mean, I heard the word Dune. Dune just sounds like an interesting title, so I checked it out. And I just, I don't know, it's just like, yes, it's a very difficult story to tell, but I felt like I understood it, or I at least understood enough of it that I felt like I was in on something.
And even if you didn't understand it, you wanted to, like, you wanted to try to, like, figure out, you know. And it's kind of like the way the Harkonnens are visually represented. Yes. Obviously, the Baron Harkonnen is really gross to look at. And he's got, like, these big, like, gross pustules and stuff. And you're supposed to be, like, revulsed by him. And obviously, like, his henchmen are kind of the same way. But at the same time, you're like, man, why are these guys so nasty? I totally want to root for Paul and stuff. And then Paul ends up doing all this, like, badass stuff. And you're like, yes.
Well, the thing that gets me about the Harkonnen, and I guess now that I'm a more seasoned Dune, Dune fan specifically, the Harkonnen come off as extremely Looney Tunes in this. I mean, Baron Harkonnen. I mean, all he does, I mean, practically throughout the entire film is just kind of cackle and laugh and float around and just be kind of a nuisance. He's not even a threat. Bulk and Skull, I'm sorry.
No, you're absolutely right.
Oh. You know, Fade and Rasha are the real threat here. And even they are kind of, or at least, the Beast. I love how they call him the Beast, and yet he's like the most incompetent manager of all time.
The Beast Raban. He's a beast because he just eats a lot of stuff.
They kind of remind me of European nobility when they got just too inbred and you had insane kings.
And it's not just that. For me, it reminded me of that drug commercial that was there in the 90s. I did it because of you, Dad. Yeah. I did it because of you. Yeah.
I learned it from watching you.
I mean, they look alike. I mean,
To go back to Kent's point about them being inbred, they totally are, though, because you find out that the Bene Gesserits have literally been manipulating bloodlines and telling who can breed with, you know, mate with who and stuff.
Yeah.
And part of what's, like, so important about Paul is he is kind of a forbidden child.
He is a forbidden child, and one thing that I wish they would have added this element into the movie. Again, there's like so much of this about the book that I really want to talk about, but like Irulan and Muad'Dib are basically kind of in the same spot. Both of them were children that were scorned. Irulan was scorned by her father, the emperor, and Paul was scorned by the Bene Gesserit. And the Bene Gesserit, God, I love just the idea of the Bene Gesserit. The Bene Gesserit just, whenever I think about them as an organization, in my opinion, they are actually more effective as an organization than the Jedi. They do embody the Catholic Church. I mean, just how their hands are in everything. They put their advice, you have to have a Bene Gesserit advisor.
Yeah. The Freemen have a Bene Gesserit advisor, for crying out loud.
Yeah, they totally do.
They're just...
Well, but I love the fact that they kind of steal theirs. You know, it's not, they're like unofficial Bene Gesserit.
But then they like don't escape.
Everybody's got to have one, but theirs kind of go native a little bit.
Yeah. Well, everyone that comes across with the Fremen kind of go native. I mean, even the Emperor, Max von Sydow's character is that he was close to the Emperor. He was the Emperor's man on Arrakis. And he goes native. I mean, his loyalties are with the Fremen. And because the Atreides are friendly to the Fremen and have proven themselves to be friends of the Fremen, his loyalties lie with them as well. One of the things that as a 12-year-old specifically that I love about this film, and in a way I kind of do now, is this hits my G spot when it comes to stories about prophecy.
Yeah,
I love how you get a prophecy, And you have people trying to figure out what this prophecy means. Or, you know, and I love how people are wrong. The Bene Gesserit, they think that they can control the Quisec cataract. And that the whole point was is that they're manipulating the bloodline so that they could – it's not because they want to bring the Quisec cataract around. They want to be able to control the Quisec cataract.
Well, not only that, they want the Quisec – in the novel, they want – her, the Quisec cataract born.
No. It has to be a guy because no woman can go beyond the thing. They knew it was going to be a boy.
They they commanded her to have daughters, though.
Yeah, but they didn't expect Paul. They didn't expect the child that would be Paul to be the Quisec cataract. They were trying to condense all power to them specifically. You have to understand that just like the Catholic Church, the Bene Gesserit is a very soft power. They have advisory positions, but at any moment, the emperor could call for the heads of the Bene Gesserit. The Atreides could call for the heads of the Bene Gesserit.
They're valuable because they can read minds too. Like, that's a helpful trait to have.
Yes and no,
but nobody trusts them. Everybody's get that Bene Gesserit witch out of here.
The navigators could take them out because they control all the commerce.
Yeah, the main power, and I love the fact that the Space Guild, who are the brain,
the navigation guild, the flying brains. Yeah,
that they really do control everything. But I love the fact that really, if you think about what the Spacing Guild is, and considering that it's actually in their name, a guild.
Yeah.
This again is allegorical to the sense of business. The Spacing Guild represents all business. Everything that the guild does is business oriented, and they run everything, but they let everyone think that they run it. You know, the Spacing Guild, they can point their finger at the emperor, and the emperor has to hop, but at the same time, they leave just enough power for the emperor to feel like he's in control of things. But when the shit goes down, when the spice doesn't flow, they come down hard, and they stomp. The spice must flow. And, you know, the profits must flow. We must get our
There's two types of profits, right? You're using both spellings.
Yes. Because religion and business, I think that's what makes Dune such an epic story. It's dealing with religion. It's dealing with secular ideas. It's dealing with kings and successions and, you know, you have political intrigue, you have religious intrigue, you have, you know, a kind of a Macbeth story kind of going on here.
Yeah.
It embodies all of these different stories, and the book just puts it all together. And so I understand why it's so hard to make a movie out of this because it's got so much going. And I mean, as much as I personally enjoy watching Dune, when someone looks at this and goes, "The fuck is this?"
Yeah,
I have to say you're right, because this really is hard. It's a hard. This is, in my opinion, Dune is the master class of science fiction.
Yeah,
I mean,
it really truly is, and I think you see that reflected sometimes in who's a Dune fan and who's not. And again, this isn't to be kind of like snobby about it, but I think that there's a certain level at which if you're a more casual sci-fi fan, this might go over your head and you might just not be that interested in it.
However,
I think that on like a certain level, to a certain extent, like Babylon 5.
Yeah.
Kind of goes in the same category.
I agree completely. I mean, again, it's because
it's not pop sci-fi. It's not Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, and it's kind of like the Star Wars prequels. And I don't know if you've seen Patton Oswalt's,
recent rant on this,
but
yeah.
Patton Oswalt does this thing where he talks about Star Wars and he talks about the prequels and how the prequels are just going to show you, like, okay, now this is, don't you want to know how the government and the Congress and the taxes and the Trade Federation, don't you want to know all about that stuff? And then you get bogged down and you lose the epic and the emotion and all of that. And Dune does it so well, where you get all of the kind of the economics of it, or the, and even the macroeconomics of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you get these awesome, fuck yeah, emotional, epic moments in the film.
Well, let's be honest here, riding a big ass worm to a battle, just, yeah. I mean, especially with a rock score, when you have Toto just putting the guitar riffs in, you know, you just, you get the goosebumps. I don't care.
Killing a dude with your voice, using your voice to blow up a giant obelisk of obsidian or whatever.
This is like,
so awesome. They put it in a video game.
This story really is high fantasy in space.
It's absolutely.
Definitely.
And again, like you look at something like the Song of Ice and Fire, the Wheel of Time, like these epic fantasy cycles. But at the same time, you can look at Dune almost as the same thing, because
Dune is the story that Song of Ice and Fire wants to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, and I'm going to put the sequels along with that as well. The Frank Herbert sequels, not the Brian Herbert sequels.
Right.
Those were the Star Wars prequels of the Dune universe. Well, but
they try and explain, here's the novel about House Harkonnen. Here's everything you want to know.
Right.
And it's like, did I really want to know this?
No.
All we need to know is what happened to Paul Modib and his children. And
yeah.
Yes. But no, it's just that. For Dune specifically, as a movie, this is confusing. I'll be honest here. It is extremely confusing if you're not already kind of either that you know what you're seeing, or that you're willing to suspend yourself and kind of go with the flow. And that's a detriment to the film as well, because, okay, first off, when it comes to David Lynch, we saw this with Blue Velvet. David Lynch makes movies basically for himself. He's only interested in really getting the vision for himself, and we see this here that, while yes, it is epic and it looks great, and especially for this being his biggest film of at the time. I mean, he had moved away from Eraserhead and his quirky little black and white movies to, you know, he did The Elephant Man earlier than that, and now he's doing his first massive epic post-Star Wars epic. And Dune, I mean, and you have to understand just how much they marketed this thing. And how, again, post-Star Wars, this is going to be Universal Star Wars. I'm pretty sure that Dino was already setting up sequels and was ready to get the ground going to make a trilogy out of this. Especially considering that he knew that there were already two other books already out there for this as it was.
Right.
But, man, I mean, Lynch was the perfect choice for this in the sense of his visual and visionary ideas. But at the same time, he doesn't know how to make it accessible to people who aren't already kind of with him. And this is something that I'm going to be critical. Even his best work, he doesn't give a fuck. He really doesn't give a fuck. And it shows. Either you're with him or you're not with him. And I'll be honest, there are times when, or there are screenings of this film that I wasn't with him for Dune. That I felt like, what exactly are you trying to get at here? I mean, I love what the visuals, but what are you trying to get at here? And I don't even think he really knows. I think that he just has these great, like Tim Burton, he has these great visual ideas and he wants to get them out there, but he doesn't really know how to convey why they're there.
Yeah.
That's the same problem that Alejandro Jodorowsky had with this work. And in a way, you know, when the Sci-Fi Channel decided to do their version of Dune, they kind of ran into the same problem because, again, this was the post-CGI world. They wanted to they wanted to do like what the Star Wars prequels, or not the prequels, but the Star Wars special editions did, and give you awesome visuals for a story that you already knew. And the problem was, they didn't know how to tell the story. And I honestly, even after Dune came out on Sci-Fi Channel, they were calling for another remake. And this thing has, I don't know how many directors have said that they're going to do a take on Dune. We had, the ones that are just on the top of my head right now, let's see, we had Peter Berg. you know, the guy who did the Rundown and Soul Survivor, Lone Survivor, my apologies. He was going to do a version of Dune. He backed away because, again, it was just too epic. Yeah. Let's see, you had the guy who did Taken. He was going to do a version. This thing has been passed around like a billion times. I mean, if you think that the Dark Tower was passed around, not nearly as much as the third reiteration of Dune. I mean, I'm pretty sure even Uwe Boll had taken a shot at it and said, I can't do it.
Well, I think let's hold off because I want to say we kind of want to do at the end of this our remake of Dune.
Yeah.
And I have a director in mind, but I think we should maybe save that.
Yeah, let's hold off
and unpack our feelings about this one a little bit.
It almost needs to have the Netflix one season long series where it's like episodically do it. 13 episodes
and I could see this being a Game of Thrones type entry for a premium subscription service.
Yeah.
Yeah, like do 10 episodes and unpack it over the span of 10 episodes or 13 episodes or whatever, and then go into the subsequent stuff.
Yeah, it'd be kind of a little bit odd to do the sequels like that, but...
Yeah.
You're kind of limited to one season, but... Yeah, the sequels take you way out where it's like, oh, Children of Dune by the ending is like 50 years later. Oh, you don't want that.
I do. Yeah. I'm sorry. Children of Dune was amazing, especially where they went with it and how they... But the problem is that with Children of Dune and God Emperor of Dune and the other Herbert sequels is that they're shorter. You have to understand that his epic was Dune, and he respected that. All he was doing was adding some more stuff. I like to think of them as expansion packs. It's like if you end at the end of Dune, you got a fully realized story. You don't need more than that. Right. But if you kind of want to know what happens afterwards, here you go. It's not that they were afterthoughts, but they were just more kind of like, I'm not going to try to make Dune bigger. I'm just going to give you a little bit more.
Oh, there's this other prophecy that you didn't know about. Now let's deal with that. It's kind of
tough. Oh, no, no. He reversed it. I love the fact that he sets up how prophecies are awesome, and then he goes to debunk the whole idea of prophecy. Yeah. I love that. I love what he did with God Emperor of Dune.
Or they've created self-fulfilling prophecies. Somebody made this up, and then later on, somebody else decided, let's just do it. So...
The thing was is that they made prophecies the bad thing. I mean, we were wanting to see Muad'Dib arise. We wanted to see the Prophet Muhammad come to power. Oh, come on, let's be honest here. That's exactly what we have here. This is Muhammad, right? I mean, if you really look at it, there's a definite, the Christians will probably want to say that there's some Jesus vibes going out into the desert, coming back to smash the temple.
Yeah.
But at the same time, though, if you're also looking at it from a Muslim perspective, there's a lot of Islam elements here, a lot of Middle Eastern lore specifically that is coming out of here, and that's one thing I really appreciate about Herbert is the Middle East vibe off of this.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen a whole lot of European Christian things. It's interesting to see it from a completely different civilization. And again, using the dark and how David Lynch takes that, what Herbert did, and give it a visual look of the Dark Ages. I cannot tell you just how impressed I am. I mean, even with the Harkonnens in these kind of industrial places with vats and I love how blood and metal are the two things that are basically the Harkonnen world, where oceans, water is what Atreides are known for. I won't say that Lynch is as good at filming deserts as David Lean with Lawrence of Arabia. I hope we'll get to that at some point. But especially when you watch that sci-fi and you know that's a backlot just full of sand. I mean, and it literally looks like a sandbox there. the actual dunes, the actual locations, the way that the sand actually feels, like it feels dirty. It feels, I just want to take a shower after watching Dune, because all the dirt and the grime and how everyone looks dirty. I mean, their hair for some reason still looks pretty.
Their hair does look good. There's some good hair in this.
Yeah, but they do look grimy. They look like they've never showered in like months, if not years, at periods. There's just so much there. But what do y'all think of the some of these kind of elements?
Well, obviously the religious elements are good. I think that the fact that it is drawing on some of the Middle Eastern stuff is good, because I feel like in science fiction and in high fantasy especially, we get a lot of European imagery. So to have this in a film, in a novel, I think is kind of a fresh take on it too. With the exception of the fact that some of Star Wars takes place on a desert planet, you don't get a whole lot of desert scenes in sci-fi fantasy. This almost feels more sword and sandal epic than sci-fi.
It does.
For a good chunk of it. And again, like, I love the visuals and I love the themes in this movie. I like the unpacking of the ideas of leadership in this film, and you get a lot of what makes a good leader from both the example of Leto and the example of Paul. You find out what makes not only a good leader, but someone that people will go into battle using their name as a battle cry for.
Yeah.
I think that's really compelling stuff, and it's really interesting to see in film. And I don't, you know, with the exception of things that are historic, you don't get a lot of that in film. Where this, I think, it feels, again, it feels like you're watching the history of something that happened. And to me, it feels more real in a way that a lot of science fiction and fantasy films don't.
What about you, Kent?
This is big ideas, deep in themes. Well, it's deep in themes that eventually get ripped off by every other. After the book comes out, I think it changes how sci-fi is written for a while. And then when this movie came out, though, it didn't really affect how it was presented on screen.
If this had come out before Star Wars,
I think that's the
key thing.
I don't think it could have come out before.
I'm going to agree with Ken on this one. It's like, I'm sorry, it's so epic, it's so big. The only way that they would have even taken a gamble on something as epic as Dune is if they thought that they could make Star Wars money. Because, let's be honest here, it is massive. I mean, just the story alone. I'll be honest here. I couldn't find a way to adapt this to a two-hour film that you could do 10 million. You had to put some serious money into this in order to get it to look even halfway decent. And bear in mind, what you needed for a movie as big as Dune, Lynch had half of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So just to remember, he is being produced by Dino De Laurentiis, notorious at slashing budgets to the bare minimum in order to save money. And in this instance, he lost money on Dune. This bombed bad. Yep. It flopped. The critics just pitchforks and torches to this thing. You know, Lynch was derided by the fans. He was derided by science fiction fanatics. He was derided by the critics. No one came to his side. No one. He was so depressed. He lost his contract to Dino De Laurentiis. De Laurentiis would produce Blue Velvet as part of his contract, but you know he gave up doing anything studio related ever again. But,
and this is the same producer that did Conan a few years earlier.
Again, yeah. Dino and
which is fantasy, and actually, if you're the difference is that's kind of an action fantasy where if you look at the Conan books, there's a very deep background.
Right. That, yeah, absolutely.
Not Dune deep, but very, very
there is
integrated. Yeah. But you don't get into it in the movies because there's a lot of action going on that distracts you. But here, there's, I don't know, if you almost want to say, more action, it would have made more money. Well, yeah. What's more action than, you know, riding worms into giant worms into battle?
I think the problem is, too, if you put too much action in, you kind of lose the why of the film. It's a tough line to balance on, but I think this film does it as well as any can.
I agree. The thing is that if you look at other De Laurentiis movies, and understand that De Laurentiis did spend some money on this. I mean, it's not like he said, here's $20, you know, on a camera, go and make, you know, the 2-hour epic. He did spend money. But, I mean, if you look at Conan the Barbarian, you brought that up. If you really look at it, most of that stuff could be done very, very cheap. There wasn't nearly the amount of production design. The Wheel of Pain, come on, for crying out loud, you can make that with like $30 and some plywood. Whereas with Dune, you had these massive cities, matte paintings, miniatures for the worms. Yes, the lectures.
You have to have miniatures, but then you have to make them big enough so you can believe that people are actually riding on them.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Location shooting. I mean, the locations themselves. Because it's not like they can go to Death Valley and do that. No, they had to go out to, like, Africa and Asia, you know, into those deserts in order to film there. You know, this is not, you know, studio backlot. You know, this ain't a sand, you know, kind of a sand pit. This is actual deserts.
Yeah, they did, I think, mostly in Mexico, but still, I mean,
true.
It's,
sorry.
There's a lot, like, there's a lot to making up.
Yeah.
I would think that at least De Laurentiis would give him, let him go to the Tatooine Dunes.
Right.
Yeah.
But
Indonesia. Yeah.
In fact, there's a set over there. If you want to use it for something, it was Laura's homestead. Nobody's using it right now.
Right. Well, I think what's interesting too is at one point David Lynch was approached to do Return of the Jedi. Which, yes. I mean, that to me is really interesting, because imagine what that film could have been.
Well, remember, he had just finished shooting Dune. I mean, he wasn't done, it hadn't released yet.
Yeah.
But he had just finished completing Dune, and he was exhausted.
Yeah.
I mean, he was exhausted after Dune. And you could see, I mean, I'll again, and I think we'll all agree here, every dime that was put in this movie, you were actually looking at twice the amount that was spent. I mean, this looks expensive. It looks authentic. I mean, I don't know about you, but I feel like we're in Arrakis. I feel like we're on these other planets, with the exception of Giedi Prime, because let's be honest here, that's a warehouse.
Yeah,
that's the only one.
That's where they save some money. Be like, okay, you know.
Okay, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And this one other planet, it always rains, so they're not going to go outside really, so we don't really have to worry about that, but. We'll just have these tiny little windows where we can flash some lightning through, and that'll serve just fine.
Yeah.
So beyond kind of like the production and the story and all of that, like obviously this film, it kind of takes on a life of its own. And again, I kind of want to get back to the idea of like, this is a rejected film. And we can kind of talk about like the reasons why people never warmed to it, but Frank Herbert himself liked it. Like he felt that it was a pretty decent adaptation. And I think he knew full well that you're not going to get everything from the novel on the screen, but he said, you know, you can come out of this feeling like you've seen Dune.
To me, I like to think of this as a compliment to the book.
Right.
I mean,
I think that's what all films truly are.
Well, some, not so much, but with this though, visually speaking, when I think of Dune, the movie, the images of the movie, stay with me. Again, when I think of the Bene Gesserit, they all have bald heads, they all wear these kind of monkish tunics, they poise themselves with Catholic, you know, this kind of very priestly, demeanor. That's what I think of when I think of the Bene Gesserit. When I think of the Mentats, I think of the big bushy eyebrows, the Kool-Aid lips, the fussy hair. You know, that's what I think about. I can't think of anything else. When I think of Baron Harkonnen, you know, yes, he doesn't float in the books, but for me, he will float because to me, that's the ultimate arrogance. You know, that I can fly because, not because I have to or that I need to, it's because I want to. And, you know, and he's all about hedonism, right? He's a hedonistic character. You know, to me, it's like, you know, when you think of the Atreides, you know, I will always have that image of Paul, you know, in between his, you know, his father, the Duke, and Lady Jessica, and just how epic they look as a family. And Jürgen Prochnow is always going to be my Duke Atreides.
Yeah. You're not going to go with William Hurt?
Never. I'm sorry. Jürgen, you understand that this was my first time, or this was my first glimpse of Jürgen Prochnow. I had not seen Das Boot before this. And for me, he comes off as the kindly but wise father. He's, you know, you get the sense that he has all this stuff on him. You have to understand, considering that halfway through the film, he's going to be betrayed. And you have to believe that he's just not a sap. That you know, that this is, I would say I guess you could call him a Stark, right? He does believe, you know,
he does get Eddard Stark.
Yeah.
Yes, he does. But for me, it's like, you have to get the sense that he's responsible, that he's a good man at heart, that he earns the respect that he gets, and the film allows him to have that. There's many, you know, his decisions, his kindness to others, which pay off. There's payoff on the kindness that he you know, he earns the trust of the Fremen. He earns their respect. That kindness saves the lives of his son and his loved one. You know, obviously she's a concubine, but I don't like calling her a concubine. Yeah.
His baby mama.
Please don't. Come on.
Assigned by the church girlfriend.
Yes, but the lady. But I just love calling her the Lady Jessica because she comes off as a lady. You know, she's not a great actress. The actress they have here is not the best.
But almost want to think in the deeper novelization, she's from one of the other. She was born of one of the other houses.
Well, she was born of one of the other houses, but you have to understand, not just anyone's going to be a Bene Gesserit. Again, just like the priesthood, you have to be of noble birth in order to achieve those ranks. You know, you can do the bidding of the Bene Gesserit, but you're not going to be one of the true sisters unless you have earned the trust. And you're sure as hell not going to be bearing the children of nobility if you're just a simple simpleton. You know,
she's not Jenny from the Black.
No.
Nope. I can't think of her as anything but a lady. You know, she earns that because, again, she has kindness. She shows kindness. Linda Hunt, which we never mentioned at any point. Again, another Belisario.
I did mention shout-out Mapes. I gave a shout-out to shout-out Mapes.
But she's also...
She's awesome.
But she's also a Belisario person because she's on
NCIS LA. She is on NCIS LA.
Yeah.
You know, so again, Belisario has a lot more to do with this. But again, it's just, you know, the kindness that she shows, but at the same time, she still shows off as regal. I just get this nobility, this feudal element. I mean, it does feel kind of like king and queen and prince, you know,
you have the emperor and the royal family, so they're right there.
Yeah.
All right. So, do you want to call it, or do you want to cast our remake?
Let's cast first.
Yeah. All right. First off, let's talk about director, though, because I think if you're doing a remake of Dune, you have to say whose vision is this going to be. And for me, I'll go first, and then I'll let you guys see if you can do better than I do. For me, I have to go with the director who not only has proven that he can successfully adapt massively complex literary works to the big screen, but do it in a way that pleases not only new audiences, but fans of the existing works. And that's Peter Jackson. I want to see Peter Jackson's Dune and let him go to town on bringing that, because I think he can capture not only the scope and the visual flair that you would have to bring to a film like this, but I think that he could also capture the character and the heart and the regalness that you were trying to get at, Eric. I think that Peter Jackson could do it.
I have another one that I would pick, but I want to hear what Kent has to say.
I didn't know we were having homework tonight.
this is totally on the spot.
The Peter Jackson idea is probably the best, but my backup, if not Peter, somebody that's just kicking butt for a story in the desert, George Miller.
Yeah, there you go.
The only problem is
you would have the minimalist Dune.
You would kind of have a minimalist, but at the same time, you'd get the story, you'd get this visual. The only real problem would be he's such a do practical effects guy. He would have a full size worm built.
Just remember, this is also the director of Babe and Happy Feet.
Yeah, so
just saying.
Your road, come on.
Yes, for me, I just get the sense that he would actually have Toto actually performing on
screen. Yeah, with a flamethrower guitar. Yes.
All right. Cool instruments on the worms. Okay. Why not?
For mine, I'm going to go with something more nuanced. Someone that is capable of taking heavy themed science fiction and doing something interesting, something exciting, who has both a visual flair, but at the same time is capable of, I want to be able to see a vision of Dune that doesn't feel like it has to be beheld to the story. I want there to be at least a little bit of leeway. And a director that I truly appreciate, and I think all of you would agree with me on this one, could really do it and do it in a unique way, especially if he has one of his best cinematographers with him. And we're talking about Alfonso Cuarón.
Alfonso Cuarón.
Yes, especially if he has Chivo doing the cinematography.
Yeah.
I honestly thought
for a second you were going to say Christopher Nolan, and I was like,
I knew that would have been the easy one. But for me though, Cuarón, especially after Children of Men and Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, both extremely heavy themed books and stories, I think that he's capable of taking Dune and going and doing something unique and different, not feeling like he has to be beholden to the book, but at the same time getting these ideas out. And especially with Children of Men, he's proven that he's capable of being faithful to the ideas while not feeling like he has to be he's being held hostage by putting all of the stuff of the books of the book into the movie. So yeah, that would be my director for a Dune if this comes across.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some casting though, because I have to be honest here. After the last time I read Dune, which was actually about 4 days ago, I had these images in my head as to who I would cast for some of the major parts. Let's start with Paul, because obviously he's the main protagonist. And Kent, why don't you start us off? Who would you cast as Paul?
You know, I kind of want to flip the book on its – flip everything on its head here a bit about how to cast everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go okay, let's just state right out. For a movie about colonialism in the Middle East.
Not Idris Elba, please.
Sort of. No. He's too well, maybe as anyway.
No, I can believe him as Duke Atreides. Why? I just don't mind as Paul.
You start just flipping the script and just make everybody that's kind of a native to Arrakis, just have white actors everywhere for natives. But everybody that's an outsider, not be like just make everybody on the outside what we would say a minority.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of looking at new actors, and I'm kind of split between Michael B. Jordan as
I had a feeling you'd actually say him. I honestly thought that he'd be your pick.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Or dang it, now I forget his name. The guy that was Finn from Star Wars.
John Boyega.
Oh, yeah.
John Boyega. Yeah, those is two options for...
No, I actually have John Boyega as a different character. We'll talk about it. If we did my version of Dune, I tell you what I'd pick him as. But what about you, Lobster?
Oh, for Paul. Ooh, this is rough. So you want to pick somebody young and fresh-faced enough that... Yeah, but who brings the gravitas? Kyle MacLachlan, like, he starts off as this, like, baby-faced Wesley Crusher type kid.
Yeah.
And then he becomes a real badass. And that's tough to do. That's tough to do in production. The only one who's done it that kind of comes to mind for me, and again, you'd have to gender bend it a little bit, but if you had Maisie Williams from... from like Game of Thrones. Like, she's, to me, she's the only actor in kind of like recent memory that I've seen make that transition from like young kid to like total badass. And I don't necessarily think I'm going to go that way with the casting, but that's kind of where my head is at in terms of, like where I would want to go with an actor.
You know what's weird tonight? I had mentioned on my personal Tumblr that we were doing this tonight, and some people were saying when they read the book, for some reason, they were actually seeing Paul Atreides as either some sort of asexual or possibly transgender. Anyway,
what?
I don't know, because he's different.
He is different.
He's different.
And I think
he's different, but the thing is that, especially considering where the story goes between Princess Aralon and Sean Young, this is definitely
if you're gonna keep the thing with the Bene Gesserit have to be women,
right,
and the Kwisatz Haderach has to be a man to kind of like
you want to keep
the gender politics kind of the same with your remake. I think that Paul, you'd have to go male. But again, I wasn't trying to necessarily like pick the specific person for the role. I was just trying to like get at the kind of vibe that I would want to go for with someone. I don't know necessarily. I'm not thinking of any like male character that's really standing out for me. The kid who was Peter Pan on Once Upon a Time and is now on Heroes Reborn. I could kind of see him maybe a year or two older in that role. And I honestly can't remember his name. But where's your head at, guys?
All right, well, first off, let me go ahead and respond to the Maisie Williams, because I actually like Maisie Williams as a part of the Dune universe, but I would, if we did the Children of Dune, I'd want her as Alia, because...
Yeah, that would be good.
No, it's just that for me, it's like we've seen her play the Paul Atreides. I would love to see her do something a little bit more darker, a little bit more sinister. We know that she can do it. And I think that the character is rich for her, especially what happens with Alia in the later books. That she becomes a tragic character. I think that it would be great to see her do something with a little bit more range. For Paul and Dune, and y'all are gonna laugh at me, but I am 100% serious on this one. Okay. I am serious, and especially after the last year, what he's done to just blow up the internet, I honestly think he's earned this. Shia LaBeouf.
As
Paul Atreides.
Paul Atreides.
A little old, I think.
No. I say that he's close enough. I mean, if this were being done like in 2 or 3 years, then yeah, he would be. Now, if we were to, you know, start filming tomorrow, then I think he would be old enough, because Paul in the books was about 16, 17 years old. Kyle MacLachlan definitely came off as a young adult, someone who, you know, in his early 20s or so. You could go up as close as up to 25, and that would work for Shia LaBeouf. And especially considering that he's got the intensity, I think that Fury has shown me that he's still capable of doing genuine acting. And I think that, you know, the trajectory and the story, the pain, the frustration, all of this stuff coming in on Paul. And if we were doing the version of Dune that I would want to put in the heartache that is the tragedy that befalls Paul that happened in the books that wasn't in the movies. Because all of that weighs down. I mean, you have to understand when he gets to the final battle, with the Emperor and with the Harkonnens, he's pissed. You know, you mentioned that Alia went to hunt down do her thing. She was kidnapped in the books, and murdered Paul's child when they kidnapped Alia. And the reason they captured her instead of killed her was because the Bene Gesserit wanted to get their hands on her. You know, so again. When he comes to face off against the Harkonnen, he's pissed. He is furious, and you can't tell me that you don't see that intensity in Shia LaBeouf's face. I'm sorry, it's there, and I would love to see him use that, but that's just my pick. All right, so let's see here.
What was your pick for? Paul? I'm sorry.
Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah. Oh, right. I'm sorry. I was skipping ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Well, let's do Harkonnen. Who would you pick for Baron Harkonnen?
Oh, for the Baron?
For all the Harkonnen.
Okay, let's do the entire Harkonnen family.
Yeah. Oh, man. Who's...
this is kind of tough.
Brendan Gleeson as the Baron.
I can see that, actually. That's pretty decent.
As the Beast Raban... the guy who played the Mountain on Game of Thrones, like just go like full on, like he's all brawn, no brains. He's the Beast. He's the Beast for Ben. Like you get it. That guy's massive.
He doesn't come off as a bully to me. And for me, Raban has to be petty. He's a very petty character, and I don't see that.
No. I could see what you're saying because the bully is actually Fade. Fade is the real bully. And for Fade, who could we do? Who is
Sting? Let's just do Sting.
Yeah, let's just do Sting. Yeah. Yeah, dude doesn't age. He's fine. It's fine. It all works. maybe Jared Leto.
I could go for that. Another musician. That works.
That would be pretty cool. Yeah. Okay. You guys go.
Okay.
All right. We're all in agreement, I guess.
Yeah. I think. Well, no. It's just you. Sting as the Baron and have it like that.
Oh, yeah. I'll agree with Sting.
Yeah.
Okay. So for Duke Leto, because we started talking about it, and now that I've cast selected Peter Jackson, I think it just should be Eddard Stark. So I'll just go with Sean Bean.
I agree. I'm sorry. That's
because he could die again.
Yeah, and then you just it totally works, and I think he brings what's necessary to that role.
Although I'm sorry, but the thing is that it's too on the nose. I mean, it's like. You know, it's kind of like picking William Atherton to be your asshole. You know, it's so obvious. Yeah. Oh, man. You know, I'm going to go with Idris Elba. I mean,
you're stealing my second.
Yeah, you're
one of my choices to be.
I'll agree with you. Okay. How about that? I'll agree.
It's either Idris Elba or Samuel Jackson.
No.
Bam.
All right. I'm gonna go. All right, if not Sean Bean, Bruce Greenwood from Captain Pike. Yeah, he was Captain Pike on Star Trek.
Yeah,
he would be a good Duke. Like, and he would pull off the guy that you wanted to be and fight for and all of that. And you could see him like paying it forward and people wanting to like him because he's such a good dude.
All right, so Gurney, let's just do it all together. Patrick 5, Stewart. 4, 3, 2, 1, Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart.
Oh, no, I was going to have Patrick Stewart be the Emperor.
Just no!
Yeah.
No.
All right, you want to know who the Emperor should be, though?
All right, you do it.
All right, so Jose Ferrer, who plays the Emperor. His son, Miguel Ferrer, you've seen in a bunch of stuff. Like, you've seen him all over the place. And he looks a lot like him, and he sounds a lot like him, and he's could totally be the Emperor. What is he? Is he on, like, Law and Order or what now?
I don't know what he's on anymore, but I'm sorry, but...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but he, you know, he got took down by Clarence Boddicker. I'm sorry, well, I don't find him.
He's currently filming the Twin Peaks TV series revival.
Yeah. Yeah. Team Lynch.
Yeah. Keep it together. Keep it in the family. I think, yeah, that would be a cool bit of casting for the Emperor. Who else could you have? Because the Emperor is tough, but he's also, like, he gets put in his place by the brain whales. So the
navigators, come on. It's let's give them their proper titles. And even though they're mutations.
I don't know. For the Emperor, I would say, you know, to kind of keep it in the realm of I love Miguel Ferrer, first off. I've actually been a fan of his long before I saw him in Dune.
Miguel Ferrer is Jose Ferrer's son.
Yeah, I know.
All right.
But what I mean is I'd say let's keep it in that realm. I would say that a great Emperor. And it would be a very different take, and since he's worked with Alfonso Cuarón already, I'd actually like to see, I would say, probably, like, David Thewlis as the Emperor. Okay. I think that he could
Thewlis.
Do that.
Oh, so
yeah.
Thewlis would be a good Yui. He would be a good Yui. He would be a good Dr.
But
Yui.
But he's played that kind of role before. I just...
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's tough. Man. It gets tough.
We start throwing out these great names of awesome actors, and I think Dune is a story that you can recast and still be.
It works. Yeah,
you can still make it work because these are great characters. It's like Shakespeare, man. Like you can cast awesome people in it, no matter what era you're making the film in.
I know. I'm just.
We've got. Well, let's talk about some of the ladies, though. Lady Jessica.
Yeah.
A little bit older, but still gorgeous.
Cate Blanchett, come on. There's no other choice.
I kind of want to have Cate Blanchett be the Bene Gesserit High Priestess, the one that's hanging out with the Emperor.
You know, believe it or not, I want Meryl Streep for that.
Oh,
Meryl Streep
can
play any part.
Very good, very good.
Except Cate Blanchett doesn't work as Michael B. Jordan's mother.
all right, so yeah, you have
Idris Elba and Meryl Streep, Idris Elba and Cate Blanchett. Yeah, I could see Michael B. Jordan being.
I want to throw Liv Tyler in there, Lady Jessica Liv Tyler.
Mm.
Peter Jackson's directing, man. He's got
I know.
Which again, Cate Blanchett, Galadriel.
Totally right. Yep, she's up there.
And she's worked with him longer.
Let's see.
All right.
Where can I fit Hugo Weaving? Because he would be too.
He could be.
Why can't he be the Emperor?
I'd say make him Mentat.
Yeah, he would be a good Mentak. He would be a good one. John Rhys Davies, I think, would be good too. Is that I'm just gonna cast everyone from Lord of the Rings in this. Richard Armitage as Stilgar.
Yeah.
I think would be
good. So you mentioned who I would have John Boyega as. I make him Duncan Idaho.
Yeah.
In my version, because Duncan Idaho plays a large part.
Idaho gets punked in this.
Yeah.
He sticks around in the original stories.
Yeah.
One of the novels, doesn't he just... Okay, I
comes back as a force ghost.
No, he gets cloned.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would
because I think it's as part of how this whole series influenced other things. There was one day several years back where, somebody had explained the whole Duncan Idaho thing is later on during the God Emperor. He has all Paul's knowledge and remembers that his only real friend ever was apparently Duncan.
Yeah, well, and they made it very clear in the books and in the movie. And which is weird because, like, hey, you're my best friend. I'm not going to see you ever again in the movie. Like,
well, the thing is that, okay, he died. The God Emperor's immortal. And so he decides, oh, I'm going to clone Duncan so he could be my friend again. Well, Duncan ends up recognizing that the God Emperor is actually corrupt and does bad things. Mm-hmm. And so, like, 10 or 20 years later, leads a revolt against him.
Yep.
He dies, and then like 100 years later, the God Emperor gets bored and goes, I want my friend back, clones him again. And they just do this repeated cycle of, I'm
so in other words, he should be Sean Bean.
Well, no, what I'm
kill
what
him I, again what, and what again and trying, again.
What I'm saying here is, one day I'm sitting down watching cartoons, and an episode of The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, which is basically a spoof of, you know, Berkman's Seventh Seal, comes on, and the whole episode is that story.
Well, no.
They're just repeating where Billy gets killed and then Death resurrects him so he can be Mandy's friend again, and who's taken over the world, and then he leads a rebellion, gets killed, and they just repeat over and over. It's like, what the hell? They're copying this story.
Billy and Mandy have done Dune references all over, including they actually did the Gob Jabbar scene in Billy and Mandy 2. No, I'm not kidding. It was like the first time I saw it, I laughed my ass. I was like, that is like the most awesome thing ever. But there's a lot of Dune references in Billy Mandy, which again is ironic considering that it is kind of a play on Seventh Seal.
Yeah, it's crossing movie memes in a way that you didn't expect.
Well, like, I mean, both had Max von Sydow, so I mean.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
Are we bringing Max von Sydow back for the remake, or
I don't know if he'd make it. I mean, he is getting up there in age. I mean, he they only gave him one scene in Star Wars. I mean, I don't think he had it in him to do more than that.
Yeah, but who would you replace him with?
Who would I replace him with? Well, see, the character itself was supposed to be kind of cunning and is the first one to truly sacrifice himself for Paul.
Yeah.
So I would say in that for that particular role, Oscar Isaac.
Isaac would be good. I could see Oscar Isaac. I was going to go with Oscar Isaac maybe for Duncan Idaho, but I could see that. I was going to say someone a bit older and more experienced.
You know, Ken, I'm expecting you to say Daisy Ridley should play Duncan Idaho at this point because it's like we're keep casting Star
Daisy
Wars.
Daisy Ridley would be such great casting for Sean Young's role.
Yeah.
As Chani.
Yeah.
You don't see her as an Irulan?
No, for her, I see like Lily James or like Rosie Huntington Whiteley or something like that.
No, right? Don't ever say that. No, I've seen Dark of the Moon. It's
supermodel-y and isn't going to be, you know, isn't going to be in the action scenes because, you know, Chani is a warrior too. Like she goes into battle and stuff. So I think you want someone who can go forth and kick ass. So, although Lily James is going to be in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, so that would be cool. Oh, you know who would be really cool and have that like weird kind of otherworldly quality? Kristen Ritter from Jessica Ritter. Jones.
Yeah,
like she would be a cool pick for a Fremen.
Actually, she would be, but there's a Fremen in Children of Dune that I think she'd be more better at. I forgot the character's name, but you know, she was one of the resistance against. I'm not going to spoil it because you know if you haven't read the book, give it a read.
Yeah, no. I'm not thinking like franchise yet. I'm just casting. Yeah. So.
Well, you know, I have to say this right now. Out of all the Art House Legends episodes, this has turned into a complete geek fest.
Well, I did not expect that.
For
when we're talking about a film that falls in the reject category, right? So we're already kind of prefacing the discussion by saying that most people think that this is not perfect. And I think that honestly, we all probably think that it might not be perfect, but it's okay. It's pretty good, right? But I think that we're all loving on the source material enough that we're willing to burn a few sacred cows and say, okay, we can make it even better.
I agree. All right. So at this point, we are running a little late.
We're running long.
We are running way long.
thought must move to action, and action must move to calling this movie.
All right. So
calling must pass through me.
Face my calling, my judgment.
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Kent Lobster, do you find this movie atrocious like the critics on Dune? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent?
Well, it's definitely not for everyone, but if you're a studier of science fiction in general, I dare you to sit back, name some science fiction that happens after the novel Dune came out, or if even after this movie came out, and find something that wasn't influenced in some way by this. I don't think you could find anything in sci-fi or even some fantasy that wasn't. So highly influential, and, you know, it doesn't deserve the crap that gets dumped on it. It doesn't deserve the, ooh, I hated that because it's not what I wanted. So it's definitely not a flunk. It's definitely not a hate. It's not for everyone would we maybe, but at the same time, it's definitely give it a shot for crying out loud. Just sit down. It is a little long, and that's an understatement. But, you know, if you've got an afternoon, put it in. Find a copy. Watch it. So it's a good pass.
Lobster.
So in 2007, two nerd geek themed TV shows, and I'm using that kind of like meta because they were nerd geek TV shows about nerds and geeks, hit the airwaves. One was The Big Bang Theory and the other was Chuck. And both had lead characters who were quote unquote nerds. And one represented their nerds in kind of like the pop culture way where they wore like comic book t-shirts and all of that stuff. And the other one, the main character in his bedroom had the poster for David Lynch's Dune on the wall. And that poster became actually a plot point of the movie, as did, I believe it was a Halloween episode that featured a sandworm costume. And that was the one that I bought into as being an accurate depiction of my kind of nerds. And so for me, Dune is kind of a litmus test about, and again, I'm not trying to like exclude anyone by this, but look, if you are a sci-fi fantasy fan and if you don't on some level appreciate Dune, then it deserves either a rewatch or a revisit or, you're maybe missing out on, I think you're missing out on something because to me, Dune is not a perfect film by any stretch, but it is a film in which big ideas get tossed about and the result is a very, to me, entertaining film. I talked about how the film has a lot of fuck yeah moments. Like that's a big thing for me in movies is, how many times in a film am I going to kind of like in my seat go, yeah, yes. Oh, that was awesome. And this is a film that like constantly delivers them. And especially in today's cinematic blockbuster environment where you have so much money being thrown into effects and like trying to recreate that like fuck yeah moment. Very few films actually nail it. And I think that Dune, to me, is like a lesson in how to do this right. Obviously, there's a lot of density to it, and it's maybe not as accessible to the general populace. But if you are somebody that grew up loving science fiction and fantasy, Dune is something that you are totally going to get and enjoy. I don't think this is a reject film. I am in the belief that this is actually one of the masterpieces of science fiction and fantasy. And I feel like, especially with when we talk about art house films, a lot of times the films that people tout as being the best are some of those inaccessible films. And I think that that kind of like goes hand in hand with talking about Dune, because for me, Dune is something that is completely awesome. And But I get how people would struggle with it. So does that then mean it's not great because it's not accessible? No, I think it's just something that takes a little bit more effort to get. And honestly, I kind of wish that, again, I feel like I'm going to get hate mail. I kind of wish that Dune had come, that this Dune had come before Star Wars. And I know that's kind of an impossibility, but I feel like Dune would be a much bigger part of our pop culture if we had seen this film before we saw Star Wars. But again, that's what might have been. But for me, Dune is a pass.
All I have to say is flying space squids. That's one of the reasons why it didn't do as well as Star Wars.
Brain whales, man. Brain whales.
Well, some of them look like whales, some of them look like squid. All right. Okay. I would love to be the dissenting opinion on this simply because it is a wacky story. But the problem here is that there's just too much good in this. I mean, yes, this is on a very, I don't want to say it's on a higher level because that makes it seem like this is like, you know, too cool for school kind of thing. That's wrong. Dune is got so many ideas and so many things and so many elements. And the movie is not a perfect realization of the story. I would love to see another crack be taken at it. Whether it be a TV series or maybe, you know, like we were tossing around, just a different variation on the story. Either way though, Dune it should be regaled on the same level as The Lord of the Rings. And I'll say, now I'll be honest here, this is the second most important science fiction adaptation that I want. The first being Foundation, which I don't know how on earth they're going to do that, if they ever do, but I still hope upon hope that we do.
HBO was doing it.
Well, they was. That's
I think it's still go. I think it's still a go.
Until I actually see a trailer, okay. I'm not believing it. But at this particular point, though, Dune, how do I put this? As a movie, as just a straight-up movie, it throws a lot of stuff out there and it doesn't explain any of it. That's a bad, this is a big problem as a film. But there's a lot of good stuff here. I'm gonna maybe it only because I cannot condone the fact that David Lynch, just kind of throws that stuff out there and doesn't really feel like he needs to explain himself. He's more like, oh, you wanna understand why I put it out there? Read the book. You know, read the book and then come back to me. That's not how you do a movie. But if you've read the book and you know the story, you're going to get a lot out of it. And that is, then you're going to get amazing stuff. David Lynch movies are hit and miss with me. You know, we talked about Blue Velvet. I failed that one. There's others I would fail, but there are others as well that I would be like 100% yes, 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 genius, bravo, David Lynch, you're awesome. And I'm hoping upon hope that this new version of Twin Peaks will do that again. For Dune, he didn't. It's like, how do I put it? He got the plane in the air. He just couldn't stick the landing. And in that sense, it's a maybe. But if you love this stuff, if you want to give it a shot, be prepared to be lost as hell. But you might get something out of it. And read the book and put it together. And, you know, that's all I can say about it. I mean, it's like, I want to pass it because I love this personally, but to be objective, I just can't do it. I cannot pass this because of the mistakes it made. So, all right. I think that, we're ready to wind down, Art House Rejects. We have our listener request. Coming next week, and we might have a special guest with us, to join in the fun and frivolity. Oh, although yeah. There's not going to be that many major, stars to this one.
No, a cast of thousands, though.
Yes.
Lots of extras who didn't know they were extras.
For all you know, you could be in this movie.
I've never been, so.
Yes.
I can't. Well, you the audience person listening to my voice.
That's true. If you have been to the happiest place on earth, there's a chance that if you were there when they were making this movie
illegally.
Yeah, this is fun. Escape from Tomorrow is the film that we're talking about, which was filmed guerrilla style at Disney World. And I feel like we kind of talked about it on a news show, but this will be Kent's first time watching it, right?
Yes. I have not seen this yet. So, and if I have to, you know, our possible viewer guest, if he can arrange getting here, he lives somewhere in town. I will kidnap him.
That's right. I forgot. So
they will hunt down. Yeah, you hear me?
So this is like a weird situation where we had a fan requested film, but it's somebody like that we know in real life.
That I have actually sold product to in my previous life as a retail person.
And I met him for drinks one time. So we hung out for an afternoon. So, I mean, it's weird, like, to be talking about his pick, but I'm glad that it's his pick, and I'm glad that he picked this one, because if anything deserves to be talked about during Art House Rejects, it's probably Escape from Tomorrow.
So join us next week as we finish up the month of January, and then we got some really awesome stuff happening in February. I cannot wait. It is Oscar time, so you know what that means.
Oscar.
Yes. So,
a time of romance.
That's true. And it also did win an Oscar too. So it all comes together.
Hashtag it's all connected.
It is all connected.
Well, do you know what we say now, guys?
I'm about to say good night.
Good night, Dune.
Oh God. I can't believe you actually did that.
Or good night, moons. Two moons.
Yes, it's two moons.
A second moon.
But this is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
This is John Lobster Muad'Dib.
And get out of here!
Thank you for listening. If you want to leave us feedback, go to gunnageek.com and you will find all of our contact information and other shows. The music heard on this podcast is by Kevin MacLeod and can be found at incompetech.com. The opinions heard on this podcast are those of the individual host and do not represent Legend Stream Canada or Gunna Geek. No infringement is intended.